My name is Chris Hufnagel, and I'm from the Electronic Privacy Information Center. We are a not-for-profit research center. It's based in Washington, D.C., although I'm based in San Francisco. The presentation I'm doing today is about how you protect your privacy. I'm going to go pretty quickly because we don't have as much time as before, but if you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand. And I'll try to answer them best I can. I'm also going to skip over some sections that I think this audience probably knows pretty well, some of the sections on computers. Let me start out with this disclosure. I don't want you to become paranoid. The data industry is very clever, and they've found out lots of different ways to find out data about you, to make assumptions about your life, and to market to you various ways, or to categorize you in various ways. But my goal is not to make you paranoid. Really, what the point of this presentation is to show you some tricks to protect your privacy, and you can take the tricks that comport with your level of interest. Some of the tricks are in this presentation, I think, are rather extreme, and you probably aren't interested in taking them. But many of the tips are not. Many of the tips are very easy to do, and they are free, and I think they're worth doing if you value your privacy. Some of my slides from today are going to be the same as yesterday, so I apologize for that. But I'd like to cover the basics first. The first is what is privacy? At Epic, I like to use this definition. It's basically not only the desire for physical space, for freedom from physical interruption, but also the extent to which you can control data about you. And this latter right is the one that I specialize in. We are interested in establishing rights in law so you can control how your data is collected, once collected, how it's used, whether it's accurate or not. We want people to be able to control whether data is ultimately destroyed. For instance, if you leave a business and you don't want to do business with that entity anymore, we think you should be able to have your data erased in a secure fashion. And so basically what we're trying to do is create more responsibilities on entities that collect data. So don't be paranoid, but the data industry is after your information. And so we're going to go through today the various types of information that are collected. And if you see what is collected and how it's used, it kind of helps you figure out how to avoid being in these databases. I should also note that this presentation is basically consumer-focused, as in consumer privacy-focused. The reason why is that many of the approaches to protect your privacy against law enforcement or against the government are somewhat different, but there is a common theme that is emerging, and that is increasingly the government is relying on the commercial sector to get data about you. So instead of following you around, for instance, law enforcement can go out and buy your cell phone records and figure out where you're going. Instead of following you around to see where you live, they simply go to companies and buy your home address and your previous home addresses. So a lot of what this presentation is about is the commercial sector, because increasingly the commercial sector feeds the government. So there's lots of different types of marketing information out there. This is from a company called Experian, which is a consumer reporting agency that also has a lot of marketing functions. And you can see that the lists they sell are categorized by dates of birth. You can see that they do some inferential processes here. They have estimated year of birth when they don't actually have it. And they also have inferred age ranges from different sources. So for instance, if you fill out a product warranty card and you check off that you have children between the ages of 6 and 10, this is where that data ends up. Of course, gender, marital status, ethnicity is one of the categories. And of course, there's a lot of physical information in these databases, height and weight, whether you have vision problems, Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers. These are all the types of information that are in their databases. There's a lot of racial marketing occurring now. So there's information, there's various ways in which companies can infer what race you are, and sometimes people disclose what race they are, and that gets placed into databases. Now, let me just explain that this is an ethnic marketing database from a company, from Experian, and you can see that it says $10/M. That means $10 per mil. Thousand, not million. So for $10, you can buy 1,000 people, 1,000 Asian persons' names from this company. And you can see that they have lots of other different ethnicities. And this is a truncated list. There's another company called Ethnic Technologies that has like 300 different ethnicities that they track. Medical information is also collected by a lot of these companies. And my favorite is the Bladder Control Database. of course, there's political databases. These have been around for a long time. There's a company called Aristotle that actually probably knows more about your voting history than you do. They'll track your donations, but also whether you're registered to vote, what party you're registered to vote for, and sometimes they can infer who you voted for. Pharmacies also sell personal information. Yes, sir.
What was that HH indicator?
I don't know. Is it household?
Yeah.
Okay. Oftentimes, you see, the marketing databases don't have to be perfectly accurate. Oftentimes, the marketing is to a household. So if you know, even if it's you, even if you're not giving money to the March of Dimes, if it's your wife, you know, that's good enough that the household is targeted. And then, of course, pharmacies sell information, too, although this practice has been limited a little bit. You can see that this is a database that I found that's actually ties loyalty cards. So if you use the club card at the supermarket with your credit card, they can guarantee 100% accuracy to identify you individually and also the products you're purchasing at the pharmacy, which, of course, feeds a lot of medical information. And this is from the same ad. It shows that they, you know, how they're tracking people by pain relief, stomach relief, etc. Other sensitive information out there, well, people consider as sensitive, is that, you know, if you order from a catalog, all the information the catalog company can collect about you is actually sold. So if you order clothes from a catalog, they note your dress size, and that's one of the ways in which people are marketed to. And of course, there's a huge increase in gay and lesbian marketing databases. This is from a company called Planet Out, and they have literally millions of people. There's also another tactic that one needs to know about when thinking about privacy. It's called enhancement, and this is where a company has some information about you, but it wants more. So what they do is they go to a company like Axiom from Arkansas or Experian, and they say, "This is my data. This is my customer list. Tell me everything you know about my customers. So I'm gonna send you a data tape with a list of all my customers, and you're gonna send it back to me with, you know, whether they have children, the dress size, any type of information you might want." And so, what's really important about enhancement is that it only really works if they have a unique identifier on you. And this is why later on I'll be talking about the phone number and the Social Security number. It's really important to try to shield these identifiers, because if you give, for instance, if you go to Sports Authority and give your phone number to Sports Authority, they're going to telemarket you. But the other thing they're going to do is they're going to send your phone number to one of these companies, and the company is going to give Sports Authority your home address and all sorts of other information about you that you didn't give to the Sports Authority, and you might not have wanted to give to the company. So generally, I'd like to say that privacy exists on two levels for consumers. One is the observable level, the issues that you can see and you can deal with very easily, things like telemarketing and spam and direct mail. There are steps to deal with all of these different problems. The problems that, or the privacy invasions that we are concerned about is a latter category, and these are privacy invasions that you don't see. This is your presence in databases, and it's much harder to interfere with these types of privacy invasions. But I'm going to show you some tricks. Overall, the key rule in life to protect privacy is to engage in what's known as minimization. That is, you share the minimum amount of personal information possible. And when you do have to give up personal information, you basically resist. There's a lot of different contexts where Americans freely give up information that is then sold at very small amounts of money to lots of other companies. And when you give away your personal information under a Supreme Court precedent, you no longer have a privacy expectation in it, and it can be given to law enforcement just as the same as it can be given to telemarketers. So you don't want to do things like fill out warranty cards. Warranty cards have all sorts of personal information that end up going directly to marketing companies. Sweepstakes are another way in which personal information is collected. Increasingly at point of sale, at the cash register, companies are asking for your email address and your telephone number. It's best not to give information out in that context, because once you've given it out, you've lost control over it under our current regulatory environment. The other key rule, the general key rule, is to protect your SSN the best you can. Disclosing your SSN to a business almost always triggers the creation of what's called a credit header, which is location information and other biographic information about you that can be freely sold. A credit header is your social security number, your date of birth, your name, your spouse's name, and your current address and prior address, and your employment information. And so giving out your SSN will almost always update this record. So you want to limit disclosure of your SSN when you're interacting with the government, doing taxes, when you're opening up a bank account or a credit account. And finally, it's really important to keep your SSN out of your wallet, because if your SSN is in your wallet, and it frequently will be on an insurance card, like a Blue Cross Blue Shield card, or veterans benefits cards will often have an SSN on it. Military IDs have SSN on it, and there's not much you can do about that. But if your SSN is in your wallet and your wallet gets stolen, it becomes very easy to commit identity theft using your personal information, because the SSN really is the key to getting credit in another person's name. Yes, ma'am. That's a great trip, and it's a smart thing to do, because there are all sorts of interactions where you give your driver's license to someone. I'm going to talk a little bit later about swiping driver's licenses, and if your SSN is on your driver's license, of course, the person who swipes your driver's license gets your SSN. There are a number of very easy steps one can take in the financial services context to protect your privacy. The first and most important is to call 1-888-5-OPT-OUT. This system, it allows you to opt out of pre-screened letters of credit. These are those credit offers that you get every other day in the mail. What is happening behind the scenes is that there are companies that are buying your information based on your financial history. They are going to a credit reporting agency and they're saying, I want to offer a credit card to a special type of person. I wanted to offer it to people who own a home and have a second mortgage or something like that. And the credit reporting agency responds with a huge list of names, and then they mail out offers to you. So you end up out of those databases if you dial this number and opt out. Under a law called Gramm-Leach-Bliley, you can opt out of some information sharing from your banks, insurance companies, and brokerage houses. So next time you call up your bank or insurance company, tell them that you want to opt out of all information sharing. And there's actually three opt-outs in the context of financial institutions. The first is Gramm-Leach-Bliley. This is information that is sold to third parties. So a good example would be Chase Manhattan they've actually stopped this after there was some regulatory pressure, used to actually sell credit card numbers of its of its cardholders to telemarketers. Then the telemarketers would call you up and try to get you to agree to buy things without telling you that they already had your credit card number. And it resulted in lots and lots of charges that were unauthorized. In one case, there were 95,000 unauthorized charges from one telemarketing campaign because the banks were actually selling the credit card number in addition to your phone number to telemarketers. So that's one opt-out that you can exercise. And then there are two opt-outs under the what's known as the Fair Credit Reporting Act. One is to stop your personal information from being marketed to a bank's affiliates. Now, banks have lots of affiliates, so this is actually a worthwhile step. For instance, Citibank has 1,600 affiliates. If you have a Citibank credit card, the company can take your information and give it to all of its other affiliates unless you opt out. There's also internal sharing of credit reports that you can opt out of that will reduce the amount of telemarketing and junk mail you receive. Finally, in the financial services context, one of the most important things to do is put passwords on your account. One of the issues I work on is stalking and the use of investigators to locate victims. And you'd be surprised by how many people locate another person or investigate other people by calling up the bank and pretending to be you to get your financial information. It's very easy to do because your social security number is in databases that private investigators and other people have. And in fact, this often happens in the context of people who are about to be married. It's frequently a fiancé calling up the bank, checking on the spouse's financials. There have been a number of cases over the years at the Federal Trade Commission involving that scenario, where one of the persons being married isn't quite sure that the other person really has the money that they say they have. And so they call up and pretend to be the account holder. If you put a password on your account, you really reduce the risk of that occurring. As a result of a federal law that passed in 2003, you now have the right to a free credit report from all three consumer reporting agencies. And this is really cool. You call this phone number or go to annualcreditreport.com, you can get your free credit report. It's better to call the phone number. It's actually much easier to get your report by calling the phone number, but then it arrives by mail and it takes an extra couple days. When you do it online, of course, you get it instantly. There's some other credit reports out there that you can get free that you might consider getting. One is the Medical Information Bureau report. Medical Information Bureau is amazing. It is basically a database of medical problems that some Americans have. You probably are not in the MIB database unless you've applied for life insurance. That's usually what triggers it. But there's all sorts of other information in MIB. If you are a risk taker, sometimes they know this. So for instance, if you're a parachuter and they have been able to note this in the database, it will be in there. And that will affect your insurance rates. So what's important about checking these reports that I should have mentioned earlier is that under the federal statute, you can not only access your report, you can correct errors. And that's the critical issue there, is that after you get your credit reports, you can try to correct the errors. Yes, ma'am?
Anybody who has life insurance through their company that they work for is in the MIB?
Typically, it is when you get life insurance and they come out and they do blood tests on you to see if you're a smoker, to see if you have high cholesterol, etc. That's going to cause an MIB report. But
even when you apply through your employer, they give you free life insurance when you take out medical insurance and stuff with your employer.
I think the answer is going to be yes, but it's best, you know, you can check free.
Yeah.
So you might want to check. I'm not sure, but I guess that my question would be, why wouldn't the insurer ping this database? You know, because this is the way they manage risk, and if you're in it, they're going to want to ping it, and they're going to want to put information in it about you. And the information is going to be often risk-taking behavior if you're alcoholic, drug user, smoker. These are all the things that they are concerned about. And then finally, a company called ChoicePoint here in Atlanta has a lot of different reports that you can access free. You can get your public records report, which you cannot correct, but you can obtain free and look at least. You can get your tenant report, which of course is used by lots of landlords. If you're having problems getting an apartment, you might want to check out that report. Of course, your employment report can be obtained from this company, and what's known as a CLUE insurance report. Now, a CLUE report is basically just like the MIB, just like the Medical Information Bureau file, but it concerns the insurance claims you have filed and the insurance claims that have been filed on the property you own. So it's a good idea to get a CLUE report, especially when you're buying a home, someone else's home. It's a good idea to get a CLUE on that report to see if they've had flooding damage or other types of damage out there. The cool thing about having these free credit reports available is that you can engage in a free form of credit monitoring. You know, all the consumer reporting agencies now have very expensive credit monitoring services. They're usually about $90 a year, but you don't need them, because what you can do is you can stagger your requests. So you're entitled to three reports a year. So if you simply request one of your three reports every 4 months, you can monitor your credit at no charge. Of course, the trick here is you have to remember to do this, but it is a way to save some money and figure out what's going on with your credit reports. One of the big problems that is facing consumer privacy is that young people in particular are using electronic payment for everything. And they never tell you this, but you know, when you use your debit card to buy something, or your credit card to buy something, it creates a record, and those records are data mined and they're used to make inferences about you. So it is better to pay with cash in a lot of circumstances. And so I'm always at Starbucks, and the people in front of me are using their debit card for their $2 coffee, or it's more like a $5 coffee, excuse me. That leaves a data trail, and it's going to be used to make decisions about you. Loyalty programs are an increasing privacy threat. It's very hard to find a grocery store that does not have a club card anymore, and you basically need to use the club card in order to get the normal price now. So there are some tricks here that, you know, the data in those databases are sold in a lot of contexts. There's some supermarkets that promise not to sell them. However, there are other reasons why you might not want to be in the database. There's a interesting case out of California called Vons Supermarket, where a man was in Vons and he slipped and fell and injured himself. And Vons Supermarket, in the subsequent lawsuit, sought to introduce his supermarket records to impeach him because he bought a lot of alcohol. And they were going to allege that he was a drunk. So there are other reasons why you might not want to be in these databases, and there are ways to deal with it. You can try to find a grocery store that doesn't have the club card, or you could do what I do, is I sign up for a new card every time I go. And finally, what you can do is you can trade cards. You can come to a convention like Dragon Con and just give your card to some stranger and have them trade with you. Yes, sir.
Well, that's a good example that you gave about the slip and fall.
Yeah.
But whether they know you're a coffee drinker or you buy cucumbers or lettuce or what you buy, is it that kind of information? What does that let them really know in terms of about you, or how important is that, what kind of food you buy? And what you do as far as like getting a new card every time you go, what does that do in terms of like every, you have so many different little reports then that they can't keep up with it basically? Or
I'm trying to pollute the database. I sign up in different names every time I go. You can, the other thing you can do, at least in California, it's linked to your phone number. So you can say, you can, you know, give them a random phone number, or frequently, I just ask the cashier to if I can use theirs, and they say okay, and that usually works. Now, to answer your question, why should you care? What's coming down the road is individualized pricing. I think what we're going to see is what we call first degree price discrimination, and that is where you get a different discount than someone else because of how much you spend. And we are trying to avoid this because we think it has very serious class implications. The loyalty card programs, I think, they tend to benefit people who are not they tend to really punish people who are not comparison shoppers. And if you are loyal, they can raise the price on you. If they know you're going to buy the Coke and they know you're going to buy it from Vons, why should they give you a discount? And we think it's going to be anti-competitive, is basically. So it's not just privacy. We think there's going to be fairness problems with these programs. Yes, sir.
I used to work for a major retailer for dog and cat foods here out in Atlanta. I'm not going to say the name because that'd be stupid. But we noticed that over the course of 1 year that the prices on dog and cat food alone went up even after the loyalty card. Like, before the loyalty card, the price was like $27 for a 40-pound bag. After the loyalty card, it ended up still being $27 for a 40-pound bag, except that if you didn't have the card, then you got to spend another $5 and buy more food, buy the same food for more price. And we noticed that in the reports from the management corporation that there was going to start being price discrimination based on just the types of dog food that people were buying. And we noticed that we've got a grocery brand and we've got the premium brands. And when the premium brands were sold, they were going to get a different price, you know, because we had this record that they had been buying this. So it's basically just an affirmation of what you've been saying. But it's already occurring.
Yeah, it is occurring. And the Wall Street Journal did a great study 2 years ago where they went to five different cities and they bought comparable items at different grocery stores in each of these five cities, one that had a card and one that didn't. In all five cases, the store without the card was cheaper. And in one case, the store without the card was 27% cheaper than the card store. Now, I don't do that much work on loyalty cards, but there is a website out there of a group called Caspian. It's called nocards.org, that has all sorts of research in comparison shopping and talking about the issue you've raised. I'm going to figure out. this is another piece of advice. I'm sure you've all done this. So let's move on. Establishing utilities is one of the important areas for protecting privacy, because you see, whenever you establish telephone or cable or electricity, gas counts, this triggers, if you do it a certain way, it's going to trigger the creation of a credit header, and your address is going to be known publicly, essentially. There are a couple keys to this if you want to protect your privacy in this area, and this is one of those where you might not want to do it simply because it's moving into the kind of more extreme advice. One is if you start utilities in someone else's name. That is, if you're a renter and your landlord pays your utilities, you generally have more privacy. Or if you have a roommate and all the utilities are in your roommate's name, you're going to have more privacy. But there are other tricks here. For instance, you can avoid giving your social security number to the cable company and all these other companies by paying a deposit. And if you pay that deposit, you can then start utilities in a different name. You can just make up a name. You're going to pay them, right? At the end of the day, they're going to get your money, they're going to get their money, and you're going to get your utilities. So if you pay a deposit, that's one way to avoid your data going to a data broker when you establish utilities. And finally, it's important to put a password on your account, especially with your wireless phone. We're finding that another area in which investigators are learning about other people, it's usually in the context of of divorce litigation, is that the investigators are calling up the phone company and getting cell phone records of other people. And then, of course, with the cell phone record, they can figure out who you're talking to, and they can figure out if you're cheating on your spouse, or they can find out other things, too. For instance, it can be used in business espionage, for instance. Telephone privacy, just like utilities privacy, only really exists when you start your utilities in a different name. Because when you establish a telephone account, by law, your name and telephone number is shared with other people for competition purposes. It's so other telephone companies can make offers to you. Now, if you don't want to start telephone in a different name, there are some tricks to protecting your privacy. One is that you'll notice that you can unlist or unpublish your number. Now, they charge you to do this, and the joke is that they have to move up all the names in the telephone book one space, so they got to charge you to get you out of the phone book. But you know, to avoid, if you don't want to pay the fee, but you also don't want to be in the phone book, you have the right to list under any name you want. So you can list yourself under Donald Duck, if you'd like, or under some strange name. Now, they won't tell you this, but you have the right to do this. And of course, you can always omit your address information too. So if you do want to be listed in the phone book, you do have the choice of whether or not to put your address in. Another issue in the telephone area is what's known as customer proprietary network information. This terrible word, CPNI, what we call it in the privacy world. This is the billing information associated with your telephone account. So, you know, when you get your wireless phone bill, it shows you all the telephone numbers that you dialed and all the numbers that dialed you. That's CPNI. CPNI is sold. You know that? The telephone companies actually sell that data unless you call up and tell them to opt out. So a good step is to call your wireless and landline providers and tell them that you want to opt out of CPNI sharing. It's also a good opportunity to put a password on your account. Caller ID was introduced in the 1990s, and there were a lot of concerns about it. A lot of people said that it was going to end anonymity in calling. There were a lot of people who were concerned about it, and we've had caller ID for a long time, and we kind of know how it works. So I don't really want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is ANNIE. Automatic number identification reveals the billing address, name, and phone number of the telephone subscriber whenever you dial a toll-free, a charge, or 911 number. So you cannot block this. This is something to think about, that when you call a company, let's say your computer breaks and you call up Dell, when you call their 800 number, they get your telephone number. You can't block it. So what happens there is they use that telephone number to identify you. And if you call up a lot and are obnoxious, they might not just answer the phone. Or they might move you to a queue that where you have to wait longer. And the opposite is true if you're really rich and you spend a lot of money. They might pick up the phone immediately when they recognize your number. Or you might be routed to special person at a business. One of the dirty tricks about ANNIE is that if you have an unlisted number and you've paid $4 a month to have your number unpublished and unlisted, when you dial an 800 number, they get your unlisted number anyway, and then what they do is they sell it. And so if you go to the website of Axiom or Experian, you'll see that they actually offer for sale unpublished and unlisted phone numbers that are collected from ANNIE. Yes, sir.
I heard that L.L. Bean had been doing this,
they had the disconcerting habit of when you called and the operator would come on the line, they would address you by your name before you had even introduced yourself. And they had to back off on that, even though they knew everything about you as soon as you called in, if you had ever ordered from them before. So that now they have to pretend they don't know who you are to some degree.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem because people actually, American Express did the same thing. They would put, "Hello, Mr. Hufnagel," when you called up. They actually changed that. They still collect the data, they just don't tell you. Because it freaked people out. People were upset by it, and most people don't know that data is still collected. Now, you know, the data should be collected in a lot of circumstances. For instance, ANNIE is used to authenticate you to your bank. So if, you know, someone from a different state calls up pretending to be you, it will help the bank figure out that it's a fraudster who's calling. But what we want to do is make it so ANNIE can't be sold. We think, you know, it's fine for companies to use ANNIE. After all, they're paying for the call. You're dialing a toll-free number. But what we don't want them to do is then sell it, especially when it's an unlisted number and you've spent all this money trying to protect your phone number and they just turn around and sell it. There's some postal issues. Yes, sir.
I just had a quick question. On the ANNIE, does the company actually have to subscribe to this as an additional service from the phone company? You know,
It's built in. When you have a toll-free number or a charge number, it's built in to the account because you're paying for those calls and you want to make sure that they're not fraudulent.
Does it show up on the bill or something?
Although you can, I'm pretty sure that you can say that you don't want it, that you don't want it on the bill, but
They don't even have to pay extra for this? They get it automatically?
No, it comes in automatically. Just as when you dial a toll call, you're paying for it. They're paying for the call, and so the argument is that they should have your number to make sure that they're not fraudulent calls and they're being billed properly. Now, I don't even think that most people get it on a statement anymore. Because if you just imagine, if you were a medium-sized business, the statement would get very large. Yeah. But the way the data will come in is through, they have automatic call handling computers that will record the data as it comes in.
Does this include cell phones?
Yes. Yes.
How does STAR 6-7 work into that?
Sorry?
STAR 6-7 to block caller ID from showing up.
STAR 6-7 will block caller ID, but it will not block ANI. ANI cannot be blocked. So, you know, one of the things that's happening here then, you realize is when you drive around and you see like Homeland Security tip lines, dial 1-800, your anonymity will be protected. They'll get that ANI.
I'm from the government, I'm
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, if you want to use a payphone, if you can find one. postal issues are really interesting. Yes, ma'am.
Always ask you, like they don't know you, who you are, and you have to repeat all that information anyway. But how do you opt out of the wireless selling, this wireless customer proprietary when they sell it? How do you opt out of that?
If you call your carrier and tell them that you'd like to opt out, and there's no central opt out. There's no, I can't tell you how everyone can opt out. Every carrier does it differently. And if for instance, if you're a Verizon subscriber, there's a different phone number to dial in every state to opt out. Yeah. So it's very hard for us to give advice on that, except to say, call your carrier.
What about Singular?
Singular, you have to call the carrier. You just have to call up Singular and say that you want to opt out. I'm pretty sure you cannot do it online.
They won't give you a written verification that they've...
When you first start the account, they will often give you a CPNI notice. Mm-hmm. I have Singular, but I can't remember what it looked like. The Verizon CPNI notice comes on the last page, on the back of your last page of your bill, and it doesn't even say privacy. It, like, nowhere does it even kind of tell you what's going on. It says, you know, that there's this information, and it's the amount of calling you use and the destination of your calls. And that doesn't mean anything to a normal human. But to someone in the telephone business, destination means the numbers you're dialing. The notices are very tricky and they're hard to find. In California, we have really good notices, but that's because by law, they're required to give us a certain type of notice. But the best thing to do is to actually call up your phone company and tell them that you'd like to opt out.
And you can also opt out of the detail listing.
If you don't want your bill to come like that, but you might want to. And again, you know, important, while you're calling up to opt out of CPNI, it's a good idea to place a password on your account.
Thank you.
Yeah, anytime. Postal issues are very difficult. You know, there's no, unlike do not call, there is no kind of central way to opt out of junk mail if you don't want to get it. However, there is a way when you are moving that you can protect your privacy. You know, when you move, you fill out that little card to forward your mail. Well, if you fill out if you check the permanent box, that change of address form goes directly to the direct marketers and they get your address. And there are some regulations in place, but they don't work anymore. So the key here is that if you check temporary, you can forward your mail, you can change your address, and they don't get the direct marketers do not get your new address. And the cool thing is about a temporary forwarding order, change of address order, that is that it's effective up to a year. So what you can do is you can change your address for a year, and then a year later you can do it again. Just click off the temporary box, and usually a year is all the time you need to forward your mail. Sir, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, you had said that we can't block ANI, but is there any way to mitigate the effects of them getting our information from ANI?
The only way to protect yourself is to use a payphone, because you see, once they get that ANI, they are free to do whatever they want with it. They can sell it. And so if you go to the website of a company called Intellius, intellius.com, you'll see that they openly advertise that they get ANI from other companies and use it to sell unlisted, unpublished phone numbers. So this is one of the unfortunate realities about how the regulation has worked. So we think they should be able to collect the ante. The question is should they be able to sell it? So let me move on. Yes, sir.
You're probably going to get to this chapter, but I just can't help saying all of this cries out so badly for laws to block it, or better yet, just laws to hold everybody accountable civilly, criminally, for any misuse that occurred anywhere in their chain of handling data. Just penalties, even more than laws. Just penalties, criminal, civil, $10 million per violation, $50 million if it's a big violation, and maybe then even ChoicePoint will hold off a little bit, be a little more careful.
Yeah, actually, my boss doesn't like me to do this presentation because, we're telling people what they can do, and it actually is used by the other side to say, oh, you don't need privacy law. Chris is going around showing you what you can do to protect your privacy, so you don't need any law. And that is not the message we want to give. We actually want laws to protect this information. But until then, this is what we're left with, is some of these tricks. But yeah, we're working on comprehensive data protection bills, and what we're going to start seeing in the states are going to be laws that make you liable for misuse of data downstream. If you collect data and sell it to another person. And I worked on a case in New Hampshire called the Amy Boyer case. This is a case where a young woman was killed by a stalker who she didn't even know. He was probably mentally infirm, and he had developed this attachment to this woman he didn't even know. And he hired an online company to locate her, DocuSearch.com. DocuSearch sold him the victim's social security number and other information, figured out where she worked, and the killer went, found her, and shot her to death, and then killed himself. And as a result of that case, there was some litigation in New Hampshire, and we were involved in it and wrote an amicus brief. And now in New Hampshire, you are liable if you're an information provider and you give it to someone negligently, and that person harms the person, the data subject. So that first case in the nation where what you're suggesting occurred, and that was a couple years ago, where we've been successful in making people liable for the harms from data flow.
Are you also trying to hold criminally accountable the executives of the companies, like executives of ChoicePoint?
You know, it's when.
Because if they're not individually liable, then they've got so much money coming in, it's mm-hmm. not.
The unfortunate reality is that these companies are so moneyed that it's very difficult to pass any law at all. And a criminal statute criminalizing some of this behavior would never pass. The companies are very strong. And although when you poll the public, when you ask the public, what should the penalty be for someone invading my privacy, about 30% of the public will say they should go to jail. Okay? And so despite the fact that there is a strong public feeling that there should be really severe penalties for invading privacy, you're not going to see laws doing that. I'll just give you an example.
After Enron and everything there's enough of an anti-corporate bent. Most are totally misguided. There's enough of an anti-corporate bent that one can ride the wave against the boy. These are big corporate data collection companies that are rich, with rich executives. It just looks like even politicians couldn't buff that.
Yeah, and in California, when we were working on a law that would make it that would give you a right to opt out of your information being sold in a financial context, the bank spent $20 million opposing us. They have so much money. They hate privacy law, and they will do anything. They will lie to avoid privacy law from passing. They'll tell you things. For instance, we were working on a law so that if you bank with Bank of America or whatever, they would not be able to sell your information to other people. Okay? And that should be a choice that you could make. And maybe you want them to, okay? But we think you should have a choice in the matter. They said that if that occurred, the ATM system would stop working. Okay, and it was clearly not true. If you looked at the bill, there was an exception that said any service initiated by the consumer shall allow the data to transfer. And of course, you know, your data has to transfer when you go to the ATM. It was written into the bill, and they were around telling people the ATM system would no longer work. This bill will make ATMs illegal, is what they were saying. So that's what we're dealing with on the other side. Now, Sarbanes-Oxley does have criminal penalties, and there are privacy protections in Sarbanes-Oxley. And in fact, these guys at Choice Point, what they're going to get in trouble for is not for selling data, but for selling their stock before they before telling the public that they had a security breach. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is going to fine them heavily for that, I think. Yeah, there's a question in the back.
Not so much a question, but just a comment. I mean, we started off this conversation by discussing that government's turning more and more to the commercial sector for information, because we're not going to go around to the federal or state government and say, hey, my name is, my number is, I have 1.5 children and blah, blah, blah. You know, looking at the state government and the federal government for help, especially in this kind of frame of mind, I mean, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but, you know, the homeland security issues we're facing now, I don't know if the federal government would be willing, able, or interested in passing stringent laws to protect privacy when they're the biggest institution trying to get our information under the guise of protecting our welfare. And so I think, you know, what you're doing is truly important. I'm sitting here, you know, I just moved and bought a new house, and I'm thinking about all the things I've done to expose my information that I didn't know before. And so I have real concerns whether the federal government in the end would pass strong laws and then uphold those laws when they'd be punishing and kind of neutering their own interests.
I think that comment is insightful, and I think you're right. Part of what we've learned is that we're much more successful on the state level. The state authorities are much more likely to pass privacy laws than federal. Here in Georgia, you have privacy written into your constitution, and you have privacy guarantees in Georgia that are not enjoyed in other states. For instance, the anti-sodomy laws in the state were thrown out before the federal government was. And Georgia was the pioneer of data destruction, secure data destruction laws. First state in the nation that passed a law that said, If you're a company and you have people's social security numbers and driver's license numbers, you can't just throw them in the trash anymore, because that's what companies were doing. You have to shred them. So we think there will be a lot more success in the states, but your comment is right. I mean, the people who help us in government tend to be the Attorney General's office and the Department of Consumer Affairs. They tend to actually go to offices with us and help us get bills passed. But at the same time, these same offices are subscribed to Choice Point. They use Choice Point to investigate people. And there's going to be some balance in the middle where law enforcement gets access to data. We think law enforcement should have access to data, but there should be due process involved. There should be suspicion. They shouldn't just be able to get your data for no reason. There should be accountability when individuals pull your file for no reason, and that happens all the time. There are lots of cases. Police officers pull files on women because they are attracted to them. We've documented these cases over and over. So we think there should be limits on this type of behavior. But you are right. There, to some extent, government is conflicted on this issue. So I'm going to be at the Department of Homeland Security next week speaking with that agency about how they use commercial information. And we're basically asking them to follow the principles of federal law and to reduce the reliance on commercial information. And what they've told us in response is, don't tell us not to, we're going to. You can tell us how we do it, but you're not going to tell us not to do it. So that's going to be next week. Let me move on to a couple more slides, and I think we'll have lots of time for questions if you'd like. Using a private mailbox is one way to shield your home address, and in establishing a private mailbox, because of federal law, you do have to give up your identification. So if you go to mailboxes, et cetera, be prepared to show your driver's license and other information. The other way to protect your home address is that in a lot of states now, you can list a different address on your driver's license than your home address. So for instance, in California, you can list your PO box, if you'd like, or your work address, if you'd like, on your driver's license. Another key issue with driver's licenses is to avoid swiping. You'll note that most driver's licenses now have either a barcode on the back or a magnetic strip. And you'll find that a lot of companies now are swiping that card and reading the data off the card to prove how old you are. Now, the problem is they are allowed to keep that data. And the data on that card is not just the fact that you're 21 or over 21. The data on that card includes your height and weight, sometimes your social security number, your full home address, sometimes a digital version of your photograph. When they've collected that information, they can sell it. They can use it for whatever purpose they please, except in California. In California, once you swipe the driver's license, you can only use it to prove that someone's over 21. Then you have to get rid of the data. You don't have to do that in any other state. So if you can, avoid swiping. Don't let companies swipe your driver's license.
In what context would places swipe your license?
They're not machine readable. The question is,
they do have like an encoded fingerprint on the back, which is fun, but yeah. They don't actually have like a magnetic stripe or anything. So
okay. That's
something that a lot of us aren't going to be familiar with.
Okay, you will be familiar with this because a federal law called the Real ID Act passed, and there's going to be machine readable device somewhere on your driver's license in the future. And the question was is who swipes your driver's license? Well, it's usually bars. There are clubs, for instance, in the Northeast that will swipe your driver's license when you come in to prove that you're over 21. And what they don't tell you is that they add your name to marketing lists. They actually sell that data after they prove that you're 21. So many of us will not have that experience because we're old enough looking that we're not carded, but that's generally what's happening.
And you would avoid that by telling, hey, just look at the number and see if it's more than 21.
Yeah, the question is how do you avoid it? Well, you tell them no if you can, and if they insist, you leave. Because there's no, you see, for instance, in California, we have some laws that are known as coercive disclosure laws, where you can't deny someone a service because they refuse to give personal information. So in California, for instance, a company cannot force you to give your social security number. You don't have that protection in other states, so you have to be prepared to vote with your feet sometimes. Other things you can do, I mean, what some people do is they demagnetize the strip. Of course, that is against the law. Opting out of marketing data is, if you don't like junk mail, the sure way to reduce the amount of junk mail that you get is to opt out of marketing databases. And there is this great website out there called junkbusters.com that will let you print out about 20 letters that go to all the main companies that sell personal information. And it will tell those companies to stop selling your data. And they will stop. And in fact, junk mail will be reduced significantly if you take this step. So that's junkbusters.com. I'm going to go through online issues pretty quickly because I think this audience is pretty familiar with it. The interesting thing about protecting yourself online is physical access to your computer is really important. The big security risk with computers now is your children. Who download music sharing or other software that has spyware in it. In my case, my biggest computer security risk are my parents, who are always downloading pointless programs that have spyware in it. My mom downloaded this mouse thing that made her mouse do something funny. I can't even remember what. It made fireworks or something with her mouse. And sure enough, there was spyware in that. She didn't understand that. And so it's important that when people use your computer, you explain to them that they shouldn't install things. Or if they do, they should not install software with spyware in it. It's a good idea to put a password on your computer. And in fact, one of the cool things about using the Mac is you have less exposure to things like spyware. But the other thing is that the Mac is set up by default to require the computer password when someone tries to install something on your computer. And you can do that in Windows too. You can set up Windows so that people cannot install things without having a password, and that's a good idea. You want to make sure that if you're browsing to certain sites and you're sensitive about that, you want to be aware of your browser history, and cache essentially tracks where you've been. Password managers are another privacy risk, although they're very convenient and they're that, you know, anyone with your computer can log into your accounts if you use them. And one of the big ones to avoid spyware is to disable HTML email. You know, when you're accepting HTML email, this is rich text email, email that comes in with images and colorful text. Code can be embedded in those emails that tell your computer to do things. So for instance, there was a company that was offering a service that would send an email to people, and you could type in whatever you wanted, the email would go to them. And then a little piece of JavaScript in that message would track what you did with the message. It would track when you read it. It would track whether you forwarded it. And if, let's say you wrote something like, this guy is a jerk, and then forwarded it, it would also go back to the sender. So if you disable HTML email, this problem goes away. It's a good idea, and you'll note that many of the popular free email programs online, like Google Gmail, disable HTML now. It's all plain text, and you can turn it on, but by default it's off. Yes, sir.
You mentioned JavaScript. If you just disable JavaScript, which I do routinely, I almost never have it enabled except for very trusted sites. Would that help you in the email as well?
I don't know.
It is actually possible to send a cookie in an HTML email, which would then associate a number with your machine. Basically, that you embed a link that's a picture that's hosted by their website. So when you read that email, you get that identifying number. Then if you ever visit their site, or you visit another one of their affiliate sites that has an image hosted by them, they can read that number and associate that page view with your email address.
Yes, that's correct. A web bug is basically what you're describing. So there is this ability to do that. You'll see that some email programs bootstrap display of messages through like Internet Explorer, like Eudora does this. And I would suspect that unless you turned off JavaScript in both or HTML in both, they'd be able to track you. But I think you're correct about that problem. Spyware is a big problem out there. The good news is that there are a lot of free software that you can use to avoid it. First, to avoid it, you want to be careful about programs you download and install. But second, there's a program called SpyBot Search and Destroy that is free and very good. And there's another one called Lavasoft's AdAware that's also free and will scan your computer for spyware and help you remove it. I've just gone over that. One of the coolest tools out there for anonymity on the internet is called Tor. It's free open source software that you can download from a group called Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's a group basically that's a sister to Epic that we work with a lot in California. Tor builds in anonymity to all of your web traffic. In doing so, it slows down your connection a little bit. But it is a really neat tool, and there might be times at which you'd like to use it. So I suggest downloading and playing with it sometime. It's a really good tool. And then finally, my last piece of advice is you want to do what you can to stay out of public records. Public records are really going to be the way in which people are tracked. The government is much bigger than it was 100 years ago. It does all these different things that it didn't do 100 years ago. And when you interact with your government, when you get, for instance, a license, a phishing license, you are any type of professional license, occupational license, you have to provide your Social Security number. And in a lot of states, that license application is public record. And then so a company can come in, copy down your Social Security number and other information, and then they can sell it. We have lists of data that are for sale, for instance, on Florida residents that are really staggering. Basically, if you do anything in Florida, it creates a public record that can then be profiled. Now, the problem with this piece of advice is that many of the things you want to do in life trigger public records, except getting arrested. You generally don't want to do that. But buying a home, getting married, all trigger public records. And these are basically scooped up by companies and sold. So this is more of a warning than advice, but this is one of the main ways in which we're going to be tracked in the future. Yes, sir.
You say here the main brokers call their other information from government or public records?
Yes.
How do you reconcile that with departments like Homeland Security get most of their information from the data brokers rather than from their own internal information services?
That's a real good question. I mean, what the data brokers do is they buy government, or they organize government data and then sell it back to the government. Yeah, they're incredibly good at packaging information and associating it with people. I mean, they are incredibly sophisticated companies. They have amazing. I would encourage you. Earlier, I talked about requesting your reports. Well, one of the reports you can request is your ChoicePoint report at choicetrust.com. There's something called a public records report. I would suggest you get that, and you'd be surprised about how much information they have been able to collect about you. And not only that, they will associate you with other people, all your other roommates, girlfriends, boyfriends you may have lived with. You'll be associated with them, and you'll have information about them, too. It's really amazing. There's a question in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering if you would briefly mention the Rebecca Schaefer case and what the current state of license plate information is in the states.
I'm making a note to myself to add in some more slides about driver's information because of that question and the earlier comment. Rebecca Schaefer was a actress who was tracked down by a stalker through a private investigator. The private investigator located her by going to the DMV and buying her record, buying her home address, which he sold to the stalker killer. It's not the first time this has happened. It also happened to Teresa Saldana. But Teresa Saldana survived. She was stabbed 20 times by her attacker, who located her through an investigator. As a result of these cases, in the 1990s, Congress passed a law and then updated it to protect driver's information. Your motor vehicle record, your photograph and other information about you, your home address, is protected by federal law now. And it is not to be shared unless one of about 10 exceptions are in place. For instance, let's say you're wanted by the police, or let's say someone has a judgment against you, or let's say you ran into someone. These are all excuses where your motor vehicle record can be transferred to another person. So there are protections in place now for that. I'm working on a case in Florida, three different cases actually, where companies have been violating this law and buying records on other people. And the case really shows why the law is in place, because the states were actually benefiting. They were actually making money from selling your information. They sell it for almost nothing. So we have a case where a company called Axiom bought the driver's information of 4.3 million residents of Florida for a penny apiece. That's how much your privacy was worth to the state, a penny. We're going to win these cases, but it's an illustration of how the government can have a market incentive, if you will, to sell your information and to put you at risk. Does that answer your question?
Well, I understood that he looked up your license plate number and was able to just contact the DMV because it was considered a public record. If you have someone's license plate number, you can then get their driver's license information.
I'm pretty sure that you can no longer do that under the DPPA unless you have some pretense that entitles you to the data. So perhaps you fill out an affidavit where you allege that the person ran into you and drove away,
right,
or something similar. But I'm going to look into that again, because the Driver's Privacy Protection Act is a very confusing statute. There's certain information is not protected. So for instance, your driving history is not protected. And I could go to the Georgia DMV and see how many accidents you have been in. But I should not be able to go to the Georgia DMV and figure out where you live and that type of information.
Okay.
Yeah. For a penny. Are there any other questions? This is actually the end of my presentation. Yes, sir.
There are commercially available ways to protect privacy. There are anonymizers, and then there are spyware cleaners of different kinds, all of which would probably help and probably do help. And I don't know if it's paranoid or not, but when you use these things, obviously you're putting your full trust that these things are good, and since there are several of them, And since certainly not all people in the world are trustworthy, you could easily imagine that one of these companies could just totally misuse that data. And I'm wondering whether that seems to whether that's happened, how much whether there's any not authentication, but any kind of way that some of these are considered more reputable or less reputable, or some way to rank them, not just in terms of usefulness, because you know the magazines will rank them in terms of usefulness, but they won't rank them in terms of hey, are these people going to screw you?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You'll notice that in this presentation, I don't really talk about products. We don't endorse products or evaluate products at Epic. It's a dangerous road to go down for exactly the risk you articulated, that you have to trust the company that's selling you the device. What's interesting is that some of the big companies out there that were creating privacy technologies were later bought by the CIA. And the CIA is propping them up and deploying these technologies in countries like China to help people anonymously reach Western material. But in propping up these companies, doesn't it make you wonder whether or not the CIA has some control over the product, whether or not they have some access to what's going on over the network? The risks you articulated are the reasons why we don't recommend products. The only product I would recommend is EFF's Tor, because we know that I know the guys who work on that system, and they are really very serious and very good, and they're not for sale. but it is a, sorry. It's end-to-end encrypted, yes, and so it is a solid system. That is a risk. You have to put your trust in the vendor. Yeah. I'll give you an example. You know, Microsoft has an anti-spyware program, and you know, most anti-spyware programs, one of the ways they sell it to you is that they find lots of bad things on your computer. They find all these tracking cookies. And generally, consumers don't want these tracking cookies, cookies from DoubleClick, etc. Well, Microsoft's anti-spyware system skips over them, ignores them. Whereas these other ones, AdAware and whatnot, see them and say, you probably want to remove this. And that, so, to some extent, you have to trust the vendor. Yeah.
This isn't so critical now. It's, you might
want to
get rid of it, but it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's a, yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to add one place you may want to go to look for some of those resources, and setting aside the question of whether Microsoft is or is not a trustable anti-spyware tool, there's a group called the Anti-Spyware Coalition, which is an industry and nonprofit organization coalition. And unlike some of the previous efforts in the industry to kind of do a comprehensive education, they're not allowing any of these spyware vendors to join. All of the current vendors have to agree to allow someone new to join. So at least there's some threshold of credibility. Obviously, there's a certain amount of let the buyer beware. But for example, that group would never allow to join any of the groups that send spyware out and then, you know, send out, buy our anti-spyware product to get rid of the annoying thing we just did to your computer. So at least you've got a minimum threshold of credibility there.
Yeah, that's great advice. And actually, the behavior that you're describing is unfair under federal consumer protection law. And companies that have done that, where they literally send your computer something obnoxious and then say, pay us and we'll get rid of it, have been pursued by the federal government. Yes, sir.
There's another major source of privacy violations that you didn't mention, and that is that once every 10 years, a census is held.
Yeah.
And according to the Constitution, they are supposed to determine the number of people living in a state for matters of representation and tax proportion, but nothing else. And instead, they ask you how many bathrooms are in your house and how much money you make and how many miles you drive to work. And the list is just growing and growing. And the Bureau of the Census is just, has actually, I think they're wanting to do that every 6 months now. And I the last time I did, in fact, the last two times I did a census, I didn't fill out any other questions. I wrote down the number of people in the house and I sent it in, and they kept sending their little minions to knock on the door, and I refused to answer any of their questions. And I think that's a way that they themselves are directly data mining.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I'll have to add census back into this in a couple years, but you do not have to fill out the long form. Under the Constitution, you only have to fill out minimum information, how many people are in your house, et cetera. And so you are free to do that. Now, if you do not fill out the census, it's a criminal offense. However, it hasn't been enforced in a long time. Yes, sir.
Yes. In terms of email, if you get a junk email, and they get a response out of the email to opt out if you respond to them, is that typically they give you their address so that they know they're getting a real hit, and then they use that and they don't really as a way of opting out? And then also, as private citizens, apart from what you've given us, if we're really concerned about this, what else can we do apart from writing our congressmen or legislators and being savvy about all this?
Those are two great points. As far as spam goes, the research is mixed. The FTC did a study on whether or not if you respond to spam saying, don't spam me anymore, what happens? In about 50% of cases, they honor it. In about 50%, they don't know what happens. So it's a mixed bag, and it's not really clear what to do about that problem. I tend not to respond. As far as going forward, I think what's most important is to tell legislators that it bothers you, that certain of these tactics bother you. In the states in particular, we really have a fighting chance of changing the law. The federal government is less likely. And I've just been given the 1 minute. So should we do one more question and we can move on? Yes, sir.
I was told at one point, I don't know how true it was, that one of the reasons the government keeps buying it from the private people is because the restrictions of information that can be transferred within the government are much more restrictive than the restrictions what can be transferred to the private sector. And once it hits the private sector, then it's free game. I don't know how true that was.
The Privacy Act of 1974 was designed to stop federal government agencies from just kind of transferring data to each other. And the idea was they didn't want the federal government to create a single data center. There was a proposal to actually create a citizen identification center, with all this information. And so what's happened over the years is that the private sector has created that database. And now when the FBI wants to track you down, the first thing they do is go to the commercial sector. And same with the IRS. The IRS has direct data access to all of these commercial databases. The first thing they do for asset searches, they don't come knocking on your door. The first thing they do is go to the computer and go to the private sector. So everyone, thanks so much for sitting through this presentation. I tried to do it as quickly as I could because we lost some time. And I appreciate you coming. I got a lot of good advice from you that I'm going to add to the presentation. And of course, if you have any questions, please send me an email sometime. My contact information is at epic.org, our website, epic.org. Thank you.